right, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Aftershock Monday. I'm your host, Jace, and I'm here with a writer who's returning to the show to talk about his recent series from Aftershock that ended, Moth and Whisper, and also about a new project he has coming up from Aftershock, Orphan Age. So it's my pleasure to welcome Ted Anderson back to the show. Ted, thanks for joining me.
Hey, my pleasure, Jace. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, it's great, man. I really enjoyed Moth and Whisper, so it's great to have you back on, and I'm very intrigued by Orphan Age as well. So for those of our listeners who maybe didn't check out Moth and Whisper, why don't you remind everybody what the story was all about that you and Jen Hickman told?
Yeah, so Moth and Whisper is a I'm trying to remember. I had a little four-word phrase that I always use that I described that I'm trying to remember if I have it specifically. Cyberpunk, genderqueer, cat burglar, heist thriller, YA comic series. It's our main character is Nikki, who is the child of the two greatest thieves in the city who have since disappeared, and now Nikki is having to pretend to be both of them in order to carry out heists and find out what happened to their missing parents. There's disguises, there's heistery, there's thievery, there's adventure, there's finding out secrets about your parents that you're not quite ready to accept yet. There's trying to grow up and having to grow up under less than ideal circumstances. Yeah, Jen Hickman obviously has been Jen contributed so much, not just the art, but just the visual style, and then also helping to really solidify the character of Nikki and making sure they read properly as a genderqueer character. And yeah, the first I say the first arc, there hasn't been any decision as of yet on whether there's going to be more arcs. If you've read it, you'll know that the door is definitely open for further arcs, but at the moment, to the best of my knowledge, there hasn't been any decisions made about that, but we're leaving it open. We're keeping our options open.
Were you happy with the way that the title turned out, like when it's all said and done? I would love to see more, but let's say that if it is just that one volume, you're going to be able to look back and say, we did something really special.
We did. Yeah. I mean, obviously, yes, I would like to see more of it, but it's what Jen and I did. I mean, for starters, it's the first time that Jen and I got to work together on a project. We've known each other for years, and this is the first time we were able to get together on a project. So even just that is something really special. But we got to do something really, I don't know. There's the way that I feel about this book is I'm not genderqueer. I'm a cis straight guy, but I wanted to create a character who is, and who is, for whom that trait of their identity isn't the thing that defines their story. And I wanted to make sure this was a character that was relatable and was interesting and had this trait of being genderqueer without making that the entirety that their story revolved around. And also I wanted to build this huge cyberpunk, crazy, horrible dystopian future. And that was a heck of a lot of fun, and having Jen help out with that too. I mean, I'm really proud of the work that we did. If it doesn't come anymore, I mean, if you read those five issues, there's a solid ending. There's a definite ending. It's I like to think it's satisfying, but there's obviously so much more that we want to do with it that, yeah. I think it's going to depend. I don't know. I think it's going to depend largely on how well the trade does, but to the best of my knowledge, it's still possible. It's still in the cards.
Yeah, I mean,
Jen and I have been talking. Well, Jen and I talk regularly about, like, oh, what could we do for this future? What, you know, what would be an interesting way to go for this and that and the other thing? So it's there. It's there.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, I agree. It's completely satisfying. But the thing that's so interesting about it is the fact that both you and Jen got to put so many different aspects of some of my favorite types of storytelling. You know, there's the whole search for identity part. And like you said, it wasn't any of her kind of discovering or struggling with being genderqueer. Like that was who she was from the beginning, and they really grow as a character. I think I said she apologized for that, but yeah,
I wasn't going to say anything. I still occasionally slip up and use the wrong pronoun for this fictional character that I created. So like, I have no excuse.
Yeah, exactly.
it happens. I mean, it happens. It's don't worry your head about it.
But yeah, they certainly grow in confidence and become more comfortable with who they are, but it doesn't have anything to do with that genderqueer aspect. It just has to do with them maturing and kind of coming into their own with knowing that, because in the beginning, it seems like Nikki's worried about survival without their parents. And by the end, you almost see this this person come into their own and feel like, well, obviously they would like to discover what happened, what's the mystery, where are their parents? But if not, you get the feeling that they're going to be okay, and they have this newfound confidence and belief in themselves, which I thought was a really good journey to take the character on, right?
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I wanted to make sure that it was I couldn't really call it a coming of age story, but it's definitely a story about, I mean, you grow up and you idolize your parents, or at the very least you see qualities in them that you want to emulate, or I guess qualities that you don't want to emulate. And as you grow up, you realize there's more to them. They're more complex, and they have depths to them that you didn't realize. And there's complexities that you're not aware of when you're a kid, just because you don't have the perspective or the experience on it. And your parents sometimes just keep secrets from you. Your parents just don't tell you everything because they don't always need to or should or anything. And yeah, that was the journey that I wanted Nikki to go on, was this starting off as not worshiping their parents, but definitely having a very, very, not even superficial, but a limited view of their parents, right. Having a limited view of what their parents actually did and how they lived and what they were capable of. And then growing into this perspective of realizing, oh, there's more to them, but there's more to me too. So yeah, I'm it works for a 5-issue series. I really want to keep it going. That's the hopes, because there's places we can go with this.
Yeah, it's almost like just the things that we learn, you know, as people growing up in a society, there's a lot more decisions to make, you know. It's like when you're young and you're kind of, your parents are paying the bills and everything, you don't really realize everything that's involved with being an adult, and sometimes the difficult decisions that you make for the, you know, the safety of your kids and wanting to make sure they have a better future than you. And that's some of the things that Nikki learned about their parents on this journey that they maybe didn't expect, right? Or thought the exact opposite. So in that way, I thought it was relatable as well.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
And then, you know, of course, being able to roll in that big brother aspect of the dystopian society that you had. And then, the most fun part, especially as you get toward the end, is sort of the heist aspect, sort of the con game aspect of it, which led to a really, as you said, a satisfying conclusion, but also just a lot of fun to read. So I imagine planning that all out, how Nikki kind of resolves it, that must have been a lot of fun as well.
It was. And I mean, there was a lot that we had to pack into this first 5 issues, because it's heists and it's multiple heists along the way, and it's meeting new characters and introducing them and a whole lot of backstory. And there was only so much room for the actual action of it. And the heist is the most fun part.
Right.
I love all the heist movies that I've ever seen. I love the Ocean's movies. I love the some of the Pink Panthers that I've seen. What's that terrible one with Bruce Willis? Hudson Hawk.
Right.
God, there's some great ones. There's some terrible ones that I love. But I mean, there's that satisfaction of seeing the build up to the heist and getting only some of the details and not all of them, and then realizing how you've been tricked and the characters have been tricked. And yeah, no, that is the most fun part, and I really want to give as much of that as possible in any future series, because that's the meat of it. You know, that's the really fun stuff. That's what's clever and it's great. And yeah, the big brother elements as well. Obviously that is a very current thing right now, to be thinking about how much information exactly we're giving up to big tech or to government or to anyone else who has the ability to buy it, how much of ourselves we're exposing on the internet, sometimes literally. And there's some very current commentary there in a way that I don't want to satirize too much, because it is already pretty awful and there's only so far you can take it, but it's there, obviously. I want to drill down into that.
It is totally. I mean, I work IT for a big company, so I
oh god, laugh. Yeah, exactly. You know,
yeah, I always laugh when people say, oh, well, you know, I had a password. I'm like, if you put something on the internet, you just have to assume that it's not private and everybody knows. Just start there, and then, you know, if it turns out that it is and no one finds out, then just, you know, count yourself lucky. That's just the way the world works.
Yep, that's welcome to the internet, people.
Exactly. Now, how has the reception been for the title? Have you been hearing good things from fans?
I have. I mean, there's been a couple. I watch the Twitters. I watch people talking about it. And if anyone mentions us, there's been a couple bits of fan art, which has been enormously fun. That just warms my heart right there. The reviews we've got have all been positive. It's gone over well. I don't know. I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to the book coming out and people discovering it all over again. Because, I mean, floppies are one thing. It's when the books go into libraries, into bookstores, that people really, really see it for what it is and understand what it is and get a better look at it. So I'm really looking forward to what happens after that point. But yeah, the reception so far has been hugely positive, and I'm so grateful for everybody who's taking the time to review it and talk about it. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and just so you listeners know, the collected edition, which will collect all the whole story, issues 1 through 5, comes out in April. I believe it's, I want to say the 20th or somewhere right in there.
I don't know either, unfortunately. Yeah. So, and also, yeah, I'm actually, oh man, I have the order code somewhere and I completely forgot about it. I had it handy and now I've lost it, but yeah.
Well, I will put it in the show notes. I'll track it down and put it in the show notes. So it's either, you know what, maybe it's the 10th that it comes out, because the 10th is a Wednesday, but that'll be in the show
notes.
Oh,
that's true.
Yeah, that'll be in the show notes, everybody. I'll put the diamond code to pre-order, or you can just tell your local comic shop, hey, you know, I heard about this great title, Moth and Whisper from Aftershock, written by Ted Anderson, art by Jen Hickman, and I'm sure they'll be able to order it for you. So yeah, it was really enjoyable, and I'm looking forward to hearing about the reception as well. I think a lot of Aftershock titles do really well in trade. They're so, I mean, the titles they do are kind of edgy, and they're not your run of the mill, but with really great creators, and a name I think that's on a lot of people's lists, and people are starting to pay attention to Aftershock now. I think you guys are going to.
Yeah, and I like the trade dress they do on it too. That was something that both Jen and I were really looking forward to, is because I like the uniformity of the trade dress. That's a really minor thing to say, but I like it a lot. I like the really bold colors. I don't know. I like it. I'm looking forward to seeing how it all looks when it's together in my hot little hands, you know.
Yeah, that's one of the things about Aftershock. All the stuff they do is such high quality, and they pay attention to, especially for a small publisher, you know, with guys like Joe Pruitt, you know, who've been around the block, Mike Martz.
It's
the little things like that, they know that do make a difference.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's going to be a good looking book. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Now, we did mention that you have another title coming up from Aftershock.
Yes.
Orphan Age, which has me really excited. Let's tell our listeners what that one's about.
So Orphan Age is, oh boy, it is a post-apocalyptic, it's a post-apocalyptic Western sociology story. And I say that, I know that sounds exceptionally weird, and there's a reason that I'm saying it that way. It's a world where it's okay. So one day there is a simultaneous worldwide event in which every person who's gone through puberty dies spontaneously, suddenly, no cause, no lingering. Everyone just suddenly dies spontaneously, which means every single adult on the planet is now dead. The comic takes place 20 years after that. So the kids who were all orphaned on that day, literally every single child on Earth just became an orphan, have had 20 years to try and rebuild the world. And they've done an interesting job at it. The world is not like it was. You know, nobody uses cars anymore, but everybody uses guns. The stores were looted long ago, and now we're on to farming. Communities are just starting to build themselves back up and form organizations and form trade routes and start to really think of themselves as something larger than just a bunch of people surviving. But at the same time, that also means that there's now forces large enough to start threatening everyone else. And so 20 years after all the adults died, something new has risen to take their places to try and control the world as they see it. The new church, which takes all the most destructive and poisonous elements of a child's view of adulthood and is now marching on the rest of the world. So our main characters are on the run from this horrible destructive force. So it's a post-apocalyptic thing in the sense that the world was destroyed, but it's a Western in the sense that it feels very much like the wandering from town to town. It's on horseback, it's guns, it's Mexican standoffs. And it's sociological in the sense that since it's a road trip, our characters are constantly going from town to town and finding new places. And all these places are built on different rules. These are communities where children had to find something that that connected them, that gave them a reason to stay together as a group and gave them an identity or a purpose. And so the worlds that the communities that they've built are very different from one another because they've had to find some unifying principle, some idea that can bring them together and keep them together. And so the towns that they're traveling through are childish perceptions and misperceptions of what the adult world looks like, recreations of skyscrapers and Lego blocks, trying to find a social structure that works in the ruins of the old world. And so that's the meat of it. There's gunfights and there's chases and there's horrible sword fights and things like that going along the way. But what really drives me on this title, what I'm really looking forward to showing people, is thinking about what is it that we've shown our children all our lives, and when we're gone, how are they going to interpret it? Because the chain of civilization has been broken. And that's kind of an overwrought way of saying it, but the direct continuity of adults pass on to children and then children, keep creating in their image has literally been snapped. And now there's a whole generation that is having to grow up without that direct instruction. And so what world have they decided is worth rebuilding? There's a lot of guns and there's a lot of horses and there's a lot of Western stuff there too. Like, it's kind of highfalutin and high-minded, but it's also really down to earth and visceral, and it's going to be a blast. I can't wait to show it to people.
And I did read in the press release that Aftershock sent me about the fact that you love these post-apocalyptic stories. It's just a genre that's always interested you. Is there a particular reason for that?
I don't know. I mean, I like the idea of kind of stripping things down to the bare bones and looking at how do people come together? How do we build our communities? And sometimes that's the material sense of, like, how do we physically build them? What are the considerations that go into starting a new town or a new civilization or something as small as a camp? But there's also that sociological question of, like, what is it that can guide a bunch of people in doing something collectively? What's the sociological principle that causes us to accept that our best chance for survival is together? And some post-apocalyptic works are very, very invested in the idea of, in a world without rules, you can go nuts and murder as many people as you want. And there's the lone wolf aspect of it. And don't get me wrong, I love Mad Max. Like, Mad Max as a film series is fantastic, but there's something very... Well, actually, Mad Max is a pretty good example of building community, especially with Fury Road, because it's also about, there is this lone guy and he gets to save the world a couple times, not the world, but he gets to save people a couple times. But really, it's about the people who he manages to defend along the way, the communities that get to survive because of him. And that's the parts that interest me, not so much the lone wanderer and the, traveling from place to place with a shotgun and a dog and, no life he can follow, but the people that he's left behind and the places that he's built. The Walking Dead was something I came to later. I mean, I started reading it in college, and I kept up through like the first 70 issues, something like that. And I watched like the first season of the TV series, so I'm not the most caught up on it. But what I loved about The Walking Dead was it took the zombie movie formula and extended it. And so you can no longer have this story that ends after 2 hours where, either everybody's dead or there's a cure for the zombie virus, or, they managed to make it to safety. Like, you actually have to keep following them and keep thinking about what are the long-term ramifications here. How do you really set up a community under extraordinarily different circumstances than what you're used to? And that was something I really loved too. So, yeah, that's a very long-winded answer. I'm sorry. It's a genre that I've always really liked. It kind of tends to strip things down and make you think about what it is that humans do under difficult circumstances. And... yeah, it's fascinating. I remember when I was a kid, the book that I think interested me a lot was there's a book called Z for Zachariah that was a post-apocalyptic thing that I think got turned into a movie a few years ago, though I never saw it. But even that, I mean, it was just one girl in the post-apocalypse and then having to deal with people who find her and the realization that just because the world's ended, people haven't changed.
Yeah, that's... and that's the thing. I think you're right. It just the idea of here's your starting point. The world has ended. what now? It's such a huge, broad idea. And you can't, I think as a writer, you can't just start with that. You've got to have a specific idea of something you want to explore, because otherwise it's too broad, right? You could tell.
Oh yeah. Like yeah. And it's, I mean, for this one, the idea of it being children was what really drew me in, was this idea of whatever it is we're teaching our kids now is how they're going to live for the rest of their lives. And what is it? What's going to happen if we're completely not there to help them? If we're totally gone after teaching them what we know, what are they going to do with the rest of it? And that's, I don't know. I still love that idea. I mean, obviously, I love that idea. I'm writing that idea, but but asking that question of what it is our children are absorbing from us, consciously or unconsciously, and how that's going to manifest when they get to build worlds of their own.
Yeah, well, it kind of goes back to something we were talking about with Nikki, and that's, you know, the way that you see your parents when you're, you know, what are your parents doing to protect you? What are they shielding you from? Because they don't want you to have to deal with it yet. Like, enjoy being a kid, right? Don't worry about paying the bills or responsibility. And at what point do you start kind of teaching your child those things? And it varies from, you know, parent to parent and from culture to culture. So really, one of the things that has me interested about orphanage, you know, you talked about traveling from our protagonist traveling from town to town and seeing things differently. It would be even more interesting if they were to be going to, you know, overseas to other you know, cultures where things were, or, you know, maybe the responsibility, you have to grow up faster over there because it's a more remote Scandinavian community or something like that. You know, there's it seems like the world is so rich for story.
Yes, I will say, I mean, I there's also a question of what I feel comfortable writing, and I feel comfortable writing about many different strains within American culture and many different sort of subcultures or subgroups within American society and talking about what lessons kids might have absorbed there. But I feel much less comfortable if I were writing something about, you know, something taking place in, say, Brazil or right. Botswana or somewhere overseas, just because I haven't lived there. I don't know the culture as well. This story is a critique primarily of American values and how they're taught to our kids. And I say values in the broadest possible sense, you know, conscious and unconscious values of what we teach our kids is important and why. It's a direction I've thought about. It's something that I think is definitely possible, but for the moment, I'm sticking to America just because, you know, I lived here all my life. It's what I'm used to.
Yeah, well, but even within our own country, so many different cultures and different
right.
philosophies.
And that is, yeah, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's definitely the characters are going to be visiting these places that have different, what's the word I'm looking for here? Overall cultural vibes. I mean, they're places that have different values and come from different places. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of different strands in here that I think are going to be really interesting. And I'm looking forward to the challenge of writing is one way to put it.
You know, well, like you said, with this premise that they're starting and the chain of knowledge has been broken. But a child that's grown up in New York City versus one that's grown up in Nebraska.
Yes.
Completely different. Right.
Yeah. And yeah. Not to spoil anything, but yeah, there is definitely that cultural divide of like where you're raised can inform a lot about what you know and how you think about the world. And that'll come into play. Absolutely.
And then you also mentioned religion, which again is another huge aspect. And correct me if I'm wrong. Did you go to Catholic school?
I did not. I was raised pretty much agnostically. You know, we went to church on Christmas and Easter, and then we stopped that when I was about 10. I'm trying to be very careful about how I write about religion in this, because on the one hand, religion is absolutely a force that can be used. Sorry, not used, but religion is absolutely a force that can bind a community together or give a community a purpose and give them something to shape their efforts. And that's something for better or for worse. There are a lot of ways in which religion can be misused and misapplied or applied in ways that are ultimately destructive in a way that's quite unfortunate and really quite toxic to the overall world. And I do want to capture that in all its complexity. This is not a story about, oh, religion is bad and will corrupt our children. I want to assure readers right now, that's not what the story is about. But there are, I mean, the main antagonists for much of the book are people who have taken religion in such a way that it fuels a very destructive and toxic and hostile worldview. And I think that's absolutely, that is a strain within America. Let's not dive too deep into politics, but there's absolutely a strain of religion that can do that. And that's what drives the antagonists of the book, is religion as a force for conquest more than healing. So yeah, I'm being careful about it. I don't want to speak ill of religion, because hey, I have religious friends, but it has a role in society that needs to be discussed.
Well, I think again it goes back to the idea of how we see things as children, because you know, I went to Catholic school for 9 years, and you know, you're taught from a young age in very black and white terms when it comes to right and wrong, and it's only as you get older and you start realizing the world is not, it's not, everybody's not, you know, completely good and everybody's not completely bad. You know, whereas when you're teaching kids these concepts, you know, the God is painted with that, you know, white brush, and the devil is painted with that black brush, and it's pretty simplistic. It's good versus evil. And so when you start talking about, you know, rebuilding a society, like you said, it can be something, religion and faith and belief, and it can bring people together with a sense of family and community. But if you're doing that with these hard lines that are drawn between this is good, this is bad, and you know, you've got your fingers in your ears to any sort of special circumstances, yeah, it can lead to problems, certainly in our current society, but certainly in a society like this, where, as we mentioned, that chain has been broken.
Yeah, and everything has been stripped away, and you have to find something that you can rely on, something that can define your life, even in the absence of all the people who raised you. So, yes, religion is a force that affects us all, whether we realize it or not, from a very young age, or even just in a very broad sense. I mean, just being raised in mainstream American culture, you are absolutely shaped by a level of religious knowledge and expectations, even if you're mostly outside it. Yeah, there's a lot of nuance to it, and there's a lot of complexity to it, and it's difficult to talk about what's coming up because I don't want to reveal anything. Right. There's elements that are going to come into more into play, but yeah, there's this the antagonists at the beginning of this story, the antagonists throughout this story are driven by religion in a hateful way, in a way that's destructive and well, like you said, toxic. Yeah.
Now we haven't heard much about the protagonist of the title. Are we keeping that under wraps? Would it reveal too much, or can you tell us a little bit about who we're going to be following on this road trip?
No, I think we can talk about it. I know a lot of the previews have focused more on the setting, because the setting is so crucial to it. But yeah, the protagonist, we're following three characters on this road trip. Princess, the 16-year-old girl from Dallas Town, the community built just outside of Dallas, Texas. Kind of naive. Obviously, she's 16 years old, which means she was born after all the adults died, which means this is the world that she grew up in. And in a way, this is the world that's very familiar and comfortable to her, even though it's horrifically hostile and alien to the people who had to deal with this death. Princess is joined by Daniel, who's a gunslinger, a bit of the lone wolf type, very much goes from town to town, quick in a fight, kind-hearted man with some definite skeletons in his closet that play into his life and his upbringing in a variety of interesting ways. And then Willa, who is an extremely quiet woman with far too many knives, who is an enigma for a large part of it. I don't want to talk too much about Willa just because she's so... I don't know. She's the interesting character. Her development is what I'm really looking forward to coming out and readers enjoying, because she's a character who's going to grow in a lot of interesting ways. They all are, but Willa in particular is going to have an arc that I'm really looking forward to showing to readers. But it's the three of them on the run from town to town on horseback, bullets and knives everywhere, on the lookout for something that may or may not even exist, and trying to find a place where they can stay safe, which, spoiler alert, they're not going to find for a while. I mean, it's a Western, it's a post-apocalyptic thing. Of course, no place is going to be safe for that long, you know.
Yeah, and we did get to see some preview art, and it looks spectacular. Can you talk a little bit about your artist on the series and how the collaboration's been so far?
Oh, yeah, Nuno Plathy. He's a Portuguese artist who is, well, phenomenal. I mean, if you're looking at it, you can see it. He has this very, very... textured look to it. That's a weird way to say it. Him and his colorist, Joe Prado, I believe. I'm actually not sure about that. I'm terribly sorry if I got that wrong. they've done a lot to make this world feel very lived in and feel very, very real in the sense that it's tactile. You can almost feel the wood slats and the grass under your feet and the thickness of the air in places. It's so beautiful. I remember getting the lines back in some of these pages, and I'm like, oh yeah, that looks pretty good. And then I get the colors back, and I'm like, oh, now it looks real good. This is a book where color adds a lot to it. There's some pages in every issue, but particularly in that first issue, there's some pages with color that does so much for the environment and really gives you a sense of the time of day and the place. And I'm really excited about that too. But yeah, Nuno has been great. We've been collaborating back and forth. I sent him a whole bunch of the material for the pitch, and he was just like, oh, it's just floored. He really loved it. It's been great. We're working our way through issue 3 right now. His stuff has been phenomenal all the way through. He keeps tossing in little details, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's perfect. Thank you. More of that. But yeah. Oh, and our letterer, of course, I have to say Marshall Dillon, who is the letterer on Moth and Whisper as well. We were looking for letterers. We were looking for letterers for Orphanage. And I just said, you know, would it be possible to get Marshall again? Because he just knocked it out of the park on Moth and Whisper. And Mike was like, yeah, sure. Let's see what he's doing. And I'm really pleased to be working with him again because he brought a lot of life to Moth and Whisper. And he's, again, been bringing that same talent to this. So, yeah, it's a really good team. I'm really enjoying it. The covers, too, I forget who did the alternate cover for issue 1. I am blanking on that.
It's Wando.
I'm sorry?
Wando did it.
Yeah, Wando, yes. That one is also really excellent, but Nuno's covers have again been really there's so much atmosphere to them. There's so much that hints at the story to come, and these are going to look really interesting on the stands. I can't wait to see them. Yeah, the visuals have been beautiful. I'm really happy I'm getting to work with Nuno on this because his stuff is mind-blowingly good.
Well, what I found interesting when I looked at the preview pages was the fact that usually you hear post-apocalyptic, and then when you see the art, it's kind of dreary, and it's a lot of grays, and everything seems like run down and dirty. And there's a little bit of a shanty town look to some of the environments, but it's much brighter than I expected, and you do get that feeling that, yes, it's been a significant period of time has passed since, whatever the particular disaster was, in this case, all the adults dying. It is a world that's still, it's beyond the we're just trying to survive stage to the point where community exists, society exists. And I think that right away from the way Nuno's art looks, you get a sense of that.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I mentioned the color of it, but the variety of shades. I'm not a colorist. I don't know the terminology. The spectrum of it, it's very bright. And that was something that I really wanted to bring in because, yeah, like you say, a lot of post-apocalyptic stuff is very drab or at least very, very uniform in its color. And that's something that it fits where it fits. I mean, I mentioned Mad Max earlier. Mad Max tends to, I mean, it goes heavy on the dusty dunes and the blue and orange contrast. And that's, I mean, it works for that. But it's also, it's a world that is inherently hostile to people, whereas this world is not. This is not a world that's been ruined. If anything, this is a world that's gotten better because you don't have, corporations dumping pollutants in the atmosphere and rivers and everything. This is a world where nature has partially retaken a lot of it. So there's a lot more greenery. The buildings, some of the buildings are being eaten away or fallen down or have been actively destroyed. And the world is slowly getting to reclaim itself a little bit. And that's, it leads to a much broader spectrum of colors and light to it. And I love that. I mentioned the sort of the material ideas of the post-apocalypse too. And that's something that I thought a lot about for this. I've been reading up on rebuilding technology and disasters and so forth. And that's been real cheery reading, believe me. but thinking about, what you can build in a survival situation like this and what things stay preserved and for how long and under what conditions can you build this? And some of those details I've fudged a little bit to make it, to give it the right feel. But for a large part of it, I wanted to stay true to, what could you actually rebuild in this world? And there's a surprising amount. This is not a world that's hurting for supplies in a lot of ways. it's hurting for people. I mean, this is a world in which there are just so many fewer people from, first of all, from 90% of them dying, but then the years since took a lot of tolls where they're figuring out just how to survive. But then there's a lot of infrastructure left, but not necessarily the know-how to use it or the materials you need to repair it. So the material aspect of what gets rebuilt and what doesn't is, it's a community decision in a lot of ways of what do we feel is important enough to preserve, or what do we feel can be taken down or rebuilt? You know, what is worth living in, and what is worth keeping, and what should be destroyed? Just because the cities are still intact doesn't mean kids want to live in them. I mean, after a few days, you don't have power, you don't have water, you don't have a whole lot of the stuff you need to survive. And even after that point, cities are graveyards. People have all died and their bodies are difficult to move. And it's basically just a city full of skeletons at this point, and you kind of can't live off it. So eventually, after a certain point, you just find yourself moving to some place where you can actually breathe. You can find water and you can maybe find food on the trees, and civilization starts somewhere else. The materials of it are crucial in a lot of ways. Again, I mean, some things are fudged just to preserve the atmosphere a little bit, but a lot of it boils down to, you know, you could rebuild this with that. This technology isn't that hard to do. This thing is a lot more difficult, and so forth. Guns, for example, I mentioned guns are still very well preserved because keep ammunition in a dry case and keep your gun out of the rain, and you can fire that thing 100 years from now. So, and this is America, so everybody in this story still has several dozen guns at all times because there's a hell of a lot of guns out there for them to choose from.
Yeah, 100%. And you're right. I mean, it's one of the things I thought about right away. It's like, okay, well, if all the adults die, yeah, you've just solved overpopulation and scarcity of resources pretty quick. I mean, most resources pretty quickly. As you said, there's such a smaller amount of people. And it seems to be the resource that would be most scarce, most, you know, the thing that these kids would miss the most is probably like knowledge for how things work, especially complicated things. The higher level of knowledge. And then there's probably a dearth of wisdom as well, because, again, these people just haven't lived. They're not old enough to really have become wise yet and mature.
Yeah, and I'm really – what you said where you distinguished intelligent – like knowledge and wisdom, that's a crucial point because, yeah, it's knowledge can be gotten – I mean, with difficulty, you can still get it. You can dig up the handbooks and manuals of how to rebuild stuff. You can find complicated textbooks and relearn the formulas. But wisdom is something else entirely, and there's a big gulf between those concepts, and the distinction is – crucial in a lot of ways. But yeah, there's knowledge is prized, knowledge is helpful, but wisdom is even more so, because wisdom is what gets you through to winter.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
well, I'm really, really excited to check it out, and we'll definitely have to have you back on, Ted, after the first couple issues come out.
Oh yeah,
so I can tell you how much I'm enjoying it. It's April 10th is the release date for Orphanage number one, so just like with Moth and Whisper trade, make sure to let your LCS know that you're interested in it, and I'll also put the code for Orphanage, the diamond code, in the show notes as well. So if you want to order that way, you can. Ted, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about any conventions you have or any other work coming up. What else do you have to share with our listeners?
I don't know. Depending on when this episode is going up, I'm going to be at Emerald City Comic Con, and I'm also going to be at Chicago Comic Con. Chicago Comic Con is March. Oh Lord, I don't even remember the dates of that. they're 1 week apart, so I'm going from one coast of the country right to the center again. So I'm going to have a very busy time. I believe I'm also on a couple panels at Chicago. I'm not positive about that, but I think we've been talking about it. I'm planning to try and make it out to San Diego, even though I'll probably die of heat stroke out there. And then, of course, I will always be at the local Minneapolis-based cons. Anyone in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, come to SpringCon. May 4th and 5th, I think, at the State Fairgrounds. It is absolutely one of the funnest places to be. Social media. I am on Twitter and Tumblr and a whole lot of other things as Tedley Anderson, TEDLYANDERSON. I think I'm on Instagram. God, I never use it, but I think I'm on there. And then I'm actually – is it okay to – show another podcast while I'm on your podcast? That feels wrong somehow.
100%, Ted. It's a big family. We're all a rising tide floats all ships. I'll put it that way.
Sure, sure. I'm on a podcast with a bunch of other Minneapolis-based creators. There's a loose collective of Minneapolis comics creators called the World Monster Headquarters, which includes a lot of really offbeat, weird individuals all doing our own things. It's got Xander Cannon, John Bivens, Pete Wortman, J.N. Monk, Charles Stewart III. Who else am I missing? Lippy McGinty. A bunch of people I am completely forgetting, and I apologize for it. All very sort of loosely affiliated. And we've started doing a podcast. I think like the second episode just went up, called Monsters Attack. You can check my Twitter page. I'm going to be retweeting about every episode, or you can just find World Monster Headquarters, WMHQ, Monsters Attack, that sort of thing. It's just a bunch of local pals getting together and shooting the shit about whatever topic we feel is worth talking about. I think our most recent episode, we're talking about the art of doing a pitch, and that was a lot of fun too. So, yeah, that's a new thing, and it's really been a lot of fun, and I really enjoy that.
Great. And I'll put links to Ted's social media in the show notes, as well as a link to World Monster Headquarters. Go and check it out. Those are real fun. When you get a bunch of creators sitting around just talking about process and stuff, it's amazing the kind of the nuggets that come out of that. So if you're an aspiring creator, I especially encourage you to go and check it out.
And creator of all sorts, too, I should point out, because some of us are working as artists, some of us are working as writers, some of us are working on, some of us are more specialized, like colorists or letterers, and some of us are doing things in mainstream comics, some in indie comics, some in web comics. It's just whoever kind of happens to be in the studio on the date we record these episodes, and we're all from a very different field. So whatever kind of comics you're into, we're probably talking about it.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of fun. And listeners, just so you know, this episode's going to be coming out the Monday after Emerald City, but it's the week of Chicago. So Emerald City, I think, is the 15th, 16th, and 17th of March. So you're listening to this, Emerald City just ended, but definitely go and see Ted at C2E2 this weekend, the 22nd, 23rd, 24th in Chicago if you're in the area. I've never been to that Chicago show, but I hear really great things. It's really focused on comics as opposed to a lot of the movie and television stuff, which kind of makes sense. You know, I'm on the West Coast, so I hit up a lot of the West Coast shows that are kind of close to Hollywood, so they end up multimedia, which there's nothing wrong with that, but there's something to be said for just a really great comic focused show.
Right, a really purely comics thing. Yeah. I love Chicago. I went to Chicago for college, and I love the city. So it's any excuse to go back there is a lot of fun, and the con itself is great. So if you can make it out there, please do. It's a trip.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll run into each other at San Diego, Ted. I'll definitely be there, so hopefully we'll be able to sync up and say hi.
Cool beans, absolutely. Thanks, Chase.
Well, best of luck with the trade for Moth and Whisper. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think you and Jen knocked it out of the park. It was so much fun. As I said, I'm very excited for Orphanage. Glad you're doing another project with Aftershock. I hope continue to do them with Aftershock, because they're such great people over there. And if it's coming out from Aftershock, I know it's high quality. I know I'm going to check it out. It's kind of like almost like a stamp of approval, right? I don't have to pay that much attention. If it has Aftershock on the title, I know I'm going to check it out. So
yeah, they're good people. I'm really enjoying working with them.
Yeah, definitely. So thanks again, Ted. Really appreciate the time, and we'll talk soon.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
Thanks for joining us, everybody. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. The Comic Source is a member of the LRM Podcast Network. So when you visit the site, be sure to check out some of our other podcasts like Los Fanboys, our official movie and TV podcast hosted by Joseph Jammer Medina, Netflix and Chill, hosted by Nick and Carrie, covering a wide variety of film and television topics with Game of Thrones and Star Wars as particular favorites. And finally, Mike and Mark's Marvelous Adventures, as these two former athletes share their love of sports and geek culture by chatting about anything and everything sports and geek related. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.